there was some mistakes there that, yes, they did happen. And I regret that they happened. I understand what I did.
An APOC fine for accounting errors for Anchorage Representative Chris Tuck. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new duties for Alaska's chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, Fran Ulmer.
It will focus on some of the broader Arctic policy issues that are specific to the 2015 to 2017 Arctic Council chair rotation.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
The minority leader of the State House has agreed to pay a major fine for mismanaging campaign funds. Representative Chris Tuck, an Anchorage Democrat, acknowledged that he mixed up his campaign contributions with his personal savings and failed to make accurate and timely disclosures. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The consent agreement signed by Tuck and the Alaska Public Offices Commission describes a rat's nest of accounting problems. It starts with the 2012 fundraiser at the Fire Tap restaurant that Tuck didn't report as a contribution. That kicked off a process where APOC found that Tuck managed his campaign money as a section of his personal banking account. Over the past two election cycles, more than $16,000 flowed through his personal account, and more than $11,000 in campaign money had been used for personal expenditures. According to the report, there were so many errors that it is beyond the expertise of APOC staff to untangle them. Paralegal Delight Mells told the commission as much at their Wednesday meeting.
Given the complexity of the issues, compounded by the banking errors that resulted in the use of at least three different bank accounts and the extensive time that has already been dedicated, the parties believe that this consent agreement is the most efficient means to resolving the violations and moving forward.
While the maximum penalty for the violations exceeded $700,000, the commission agreed to a fine of $14,000 in an effort to match the proportionate harm to the public. Tuck is also required to forfeit $6,000 of leftover campaign funds and to correct his old financial disclosure reports. The commission also acknowledged that Tuck took great efforts to deal with the reporting problems once they were brought to light. After the agreement was signed, Tuck remarked that the errors were unintentional, that they were the result of sloppy accounting and not anything deliberate. For example, he says campaign funds went toward personal expenditures because he mixed up his debit cards and he tried to repay that money immediately. Tuck wishes he'd been more careful.
There was some mistakes there that, yes, they did happen, and I regret that they happened. I understand what I did. I'm sorry for making those mistakes.
But Tuck also thinks that a $14,000 fine is too high. He says he alerted APOC to some of the errors mentioned in the consent agreement and that the public wouldn't be aware of them if he hadn't been cooperative. He's concerned that a fine of this size might prevent candidates from self-reporting if they bungle their records, and that it could potentially discourage people from running for office. Tuck says he would have taken the case to court if he had the time and money.
This is one of the toughest things I have ever gone through. I've gone through divorce and custody battle, and this is right up there with that.
Tuck is running for a fourth term in the state legislature, and his race is uncontested. He says from here on out, he'll have an accountant manage his books. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Secretary of State John Kerry today named former Coast Guard Commandant Robert Papp as special representative to the Arctic. Kerry created the new position to elevate Arctic issues in America's foreign policy and national security strategy as the U.S. prepares to assume the chair of the Arctic Council. Papp was head of the Coast Guard from 2010 until he retired in May. Both Alaska senators praised the appointment and said Papp has substantial experience in the region. In a 2012 address, Papp said he'd seen the changing Arctic firsthand. When he was new to the service in July 1976, he was sent in a helicopter to look for a way to get a Coast Guard cutter from Nome to the North Slope.
I was amazed that, first of all, we didn't find any leads in the ice going through the Bering Strait. And as we landed in Kotzebue, as I looked out across the water, all I could see was ice. Ice as far as I could see.
Fast forward 3 decades. As commandant, he decided to go back to Kotzebue.
And as we were landing, I looked out as far as I could see, and I saw no ice. Same time of the year, 34 years later, there's no ice.
Carey also announced the appointment of former Alaska Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer as Special Advisor on Arctic Science and Policy. Ulmer says it will be in addition to her current post as Chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission.
But this role is a slight expansion of that in that it will focus on some of the broader Arctic policy issues that are specific to the 2015 to 2017 Arctic Council Chair rotation.
Ulmer says it's important for Alaskans to have an opportunity to engage with the Arctic Council.
If you look at what has been done recently there in terms of search and rescue and oil spill response and research in ocean acidification and the health of marine mammals, these things are important regionally, nationally, locally, globally.
Secretary Carey says Papp plans to visit Alaska soon to consult with policymakers. A U.S. Senate bill requiring companies to cover birth control in employee health care plans failed a procedural vote today. Both Alaska senators voted for the bill, aimed at undoing the Supreme Court's decision in the Hobby Lobby case. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of only 3 Republicans to vote for the measure, dubbed the Not My Boss's Business Act. It fell 4 votes short of the 60 needed to proceed. The legislation would have restored a provision of the Affordable Care Act that requires companies to provide workers with coverage for all legal forms of contraception. In the Hobby Lobby decision, the court allowed closely held companies to refuse birth control coverage on religious grounds. The case is seen as pitting a woman's access to contraception against her boss's religious freedom. Murkowski chose the other side of the issue in 2012 when she voted for an amendment to allow any employer with moral objections to opt out of the requirement to cover birth control. A few days later, Murkowski told Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley she regretted that vote and felt she'd let down people who'd believed in her. Murkowski issued a written statement today saying her vote is consistent with her long-held belief that women should have access to affordable birth control. She says she's still seeking to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but doesn't think access to health care services should be restricted in the meantime. The bill never stood much of a chance of passing, but Democrats hope the issue will help rally their base to the polls in November. A Superior Court judge in Anchorage has blocked a law restricting Medicaid payments for abortion from going into effect. In an order issued yesterday, Judge John Suddick wrote that there are serious questions of constitutional validity of the new state law that puts limits on what qualifies as a medically necessary abortion. The state was supposed to start enforcing the law today. The law passed after similar regulations were put on hold by the same judge. Both the law and the regulations are the subject of a lawsuit brought by Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researchers examine phytoplankton in the Arctic.
The deeper we went into the ice, the more phytoplankton there were, and they reached amazing concentrations to the point where it was the largest bloom anybody had ever seen anywhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
Details are emerging about an explosion that injured a Petersburg man over the weekend and has brought federal explosives agents there to investigate. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Petersburg police Tuesday issued a press release outlining the incident and some of the resulting investigation. Since no criminal charges have been filed, police are declining to identify the person injured in the explosion Sunday, other than to say it was a 59-year-old Petersburg resident. In their press release, police say the department received a 911 call reporting a person laying outside of the hospital emergency room at 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon. The caller requested assistance getting the person into the hospital and reported the injury could have been caused by dynamite. Emergency medical volunteers and firefighters, along with local police officers, helped hospital staff get the injured person into the emergency room. Police say the person confirmed those injuries were the result of an explosion. Police then cordoned off the area, shutting down the street and access to the emergency room. Officers found what appeared to be about 20 pounds of a gelatinized substance in the vehicle that the injured person was thought to have driven to the hospital. Officers notified hospital staff and moved a large dump truck directly behind that vehicle. Police say residents in the area were notified and some evacuated. Police say they consulted with a local construction company, State Department of Transportation staff, and personnel from Fort Richardson before Public Works employees eventually moved those explosives away from the hospital. Agents with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms are in town, and they've brought an explosive detecting dog. An investigator with the State Fire Marshal's office is also here. Local officers, along with federal agents, also served search warrants Monday at a home on North Nordic Drive, along with a vehicle left near the Petersburg Medical Center. And residue from the explosion site and that vehicle were tentatively identified as a commercially available explosive. A police car, meanwhile, was stationed outside a North Nordic Drive home that belongs to Mark and Pat Weaver on Monday, and police tape cordoned off the yard of that home from the street. Mark Weaver turned 59 on Saturday. That police investigation continues, and authorities say more information will be available later. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Donlin Gold is in a multi-year permitting process for the proposed gold mine located north of Crooked Creek, about 120 miles upriver from Bethel. Scientists and engineers are now studying not just Donlin's proposed plan, but several variations that would significantly change the mine. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
Anticipating more than 100 permits, regulators are writing a 2,000-page environmental impact statement about Donlin Gold's plans to mine 1 million ounces of gold per year from an open-pit mine. But they're not just looking at the company's ideas.
The law requires that we kind of step away from the Donlin proposal and think a little more broadly about potential alternative technologies or processes and at least fully analyze those.
Taylor Brelsford is a senior scientist for URS, an international engineering and environmental company that's doing the heavy technical work for the Army Corps of Engineers. The team is looking at about 8 major alternatives, some of which have been considered by Donlin in the past. Donlin's proposed a hugely expensive natural gas pipeline from Cook Inlet to southwest Alaska, plus barging diesel up the Kuskokwim. Don Cool is the project manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
You know, a lot of these we looked at were ways to reduce the amount of diesel that would have to be barged on the Kuskokwim.
Building a diesel pipeline instead would eliminate about 40 million gallons of fuel going up to the Jungjuk port site. But Brelsford says each alternative has unique challenges.
A diesel pipeline is more difficult to build. It is a bigger risk if there were ever a spill by comparison to LNG. So that, you know, kind of shows the trade-offs that are involved in one alternative versus another.
Another option involves having large trucks at the mine run on LNG instead of diesel. They will also study having the port site nearly 70 miles further downriver at Birch Tree Crossing. The team of more than 50 specialists will also study changes to the mine site, such as changing the tailings dam to dry storage instead of the dammed area with water, and looking at allowing discharge of some treated wastewater rather than keeping it all on site. Another option involves running the gas pipeline through the Dalzell Gorge near Rainy Pass, as was considered before by Donlin. The draft EIS is not due for another year. People will then see the details of the 8 alternatives. In the meantime, the Corps of Engineers does not plan to release much new information, but says some details will be in a newsletter this month. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska LNG Project hosted a community meeting in Anchorage last night. About 90 people listened to an explanation of the newest version of a plan to get natural gas from the North Slope to market. Project manager Steve Butt says this project is different from previous failed attempts to build a gas pipeline.
An LNG project is when resource owners work together to create an infrastructure to connect that resource to a market. It's regulated differently, it has different business risks, and it's a different business model. A pipeline is an important part of our project, but what we're really trying to do is deliver gas to global markets, not just to any one market.
Butt says Alaska has some advantages over other natural gas producers. Unlike for oil, the cold weather helps when transporting gas because it keeps the gas condensed. It only takes 2 weeks to ship LNG to Asia from Alaska, and the project can use some of the oil drilling technology and infrastructure that is already in place. But the hour-and-a-half-long presentation still left some community members with questions. Butt says he can't talk specifics. However, they are researching markets during this preliminary design phase.
We don't ever really talk about price, but what marketers do is they work with buyers to understand their interest and appetite for the gas, and they come up with structures that work for those buyers over very long time frames and prices that work. And they build in mechanisms that create different flexibilities to recognize different risks.
Wasilla resident Carol Shea says she questions how to predict the future markets. What if China decides to use renewables instead?
Boy, it's a risky thing. It's amazing. But we might benefit tremendously, so.
Community member Ross Beeling agrees.
It's very important, not just for jobs. It's important to improve the living standards of those that haven't enjoyed those, quite honestly.
Beeling references the five potential outtakes from the line that would provide natural gas to Alaskans. At the moment, only two are set, one for Fairbanks and one for Anchorage. At this point, the LNG project is still in the preliminary design phase. Steve Butt says it could take up to 6 years to obtain the hundreds of necessary permits, secure the market, and finalize the design. Then it would take another 6 years and anywhere from $45 to $65 billion to build.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
The fall chum salmon season on the Yukon begins today. This year's run is expected to be strong, more than 850,000 fish, likely more. Even with fishermen relying on chums in the face of unprecedented king salmon closures, fish and game biologist Jeff Eftenston says it should be enough to fill fish racks up and down the river.
So we don't anticipate, because of our run size this year, that there'll be any restrictions to the subsistence fishery, and that everybody should be able to get their subsistence needs.
Eftenston says the strong fall chum run will mean commercial openings in the lower Yukon as well. But while subsistence salmon fishing on the lower river through Galena has been open for some time, fishermen in Yukon near Stevens Village and Fort Yukon still can't fish at all out of concern for Chinook. And when it comes to those imperiled kings, fish and game biologist Stephanie Schmidt says the numbers are looking better than the dire predictions from earlier this year, but they're still far from good.
Run is nearly over in the lower Yukon, and the cumulative passage at the sonar project near Pilot Station is approximately 136,000 Chinook salmon.
Schmidt says this year's run is also a full week earlier than the historical average run time, as the final pulse of Chinook escapes into Canada, estimated to be up to 63,000 fish above the escapement target. Schmidt points to successful management and restraint from users along the river. As for those fishermen on the upper river still waiting for salmon, biologist Eftenston says those openings will come, and he's prepared to halt the commercial harvest if subsistence users upriver can't catch what they need.
If we get to points like we did last year where we kind of have doldrums or kind of a lull, as we like to call it, we may find ourselves, you know, pulling back a little bit on the commercial fishery to let some fish by so that we have some going upriver for subsistence. Then once we get back to where we feel like we need to be, then we resume commercial fishing.
As the Chinook finish up their trip in American waters, subsistence salmon fishing should open up along the Yukon, upper Yukon, soon, as early as this weekend. They're not recognizable like polar bears or whales, but phytoplankton are a key part of life in the Arctic. And now they're at the center of a new research effort to predict how the region will respond to climate change. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
Almost every animal in the Arctic eats or eats something that consumes phytoplankton. They're tiny specks of algae that usually blossom into big clouds out in the ocean in the springtime. But that's not what Kevin Arrigo saw a few years back when he was in the Chukchi Sea for a research cruise funded by NASA.
The deeper we went into the ice, the more phytoplankton there were. And they reached amazing concentrations to the point where it was the largest bloom anybody had ever seen anywhere in the world's oceans. And it was under 3 feet of ice.
Phytoplankton need two things to grow, nutrients and light. In the past, scientists have assumed that sun can't get through thick Arctic sea ice. But as the Earth warms up, the ice is thinning out, and it's definitely easier for light to get through.
The thing we didn't know was what the nutrient distributions look like, particularly before the bloom starts, so early in the spring, because nobody's ever been in the Chukchi Sea sampling the entire ocean from top to bottom that time of year.
That's what Arrigo set out to do this spring with a team of about 40 other scientists. They examined phytoplankton with a grant from the National Science Foundation. That paid for a trip aboard the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy. Arrigo says it was an ideal vessel for the environment, but there were some roadblocks it couldn't plow through.
We were really unlucky in that everything happened late this year. And so the melt ponds never formed while we were out there. And the phytoplankton under the ice never developed because there was never enough ice. But it's, you know, we were really happy with the results because we know now that the whole region, the entire Chukchi Sea, is really a prime habitat for this thing, for these things to develop.
Bob Pickart is the lead physical oceanographer for this project. He says he's coming away with hundreds of water samples from up and down the Chukchi Sea, all loaded with nutrients.
These nutrients, they spur the growth of the phytoplankton, and then from there on, it just spirals right up the food chain. So it's like the base of the ecosystem. This is what it's all about.
Pickart says there's a lot of work ahead to analyze the samples and share findings with other scientists on the team.
They have to know, and why are the nutrients in the water in the first place? How they get there? Where does the water go? What's the timing of the water? You know, so they have to know all about the physics of the circulation on the Chukchi Shelf in order to then understand the biology.
Arrigo is a biologist, and he has his own questions about the timing of the phytoplankton bloom.
Productivity has been shifting earlier and earlier because the ice is melting earlier and earlier. But now it's the bloom, the productivity's not even waiting for the ice to melt.
If it's coming earlier than animals are used to,
what's going to happen to them? You know, are they going to produce their offspring at a point when the bloom's already happened? It's too late. There's no food in the water.
The best chance of predicting that, Arrigo says, is to understand how the phytoplankton are interacting with their environment right now. That's why the researchers are hoping to return to the Chukchi Sea next year to gather more water samples and a better look at the bottom of the Arctic food web. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Scientists have long believed melting permafrost emits large amounts of carbon-rich greenhouse gases like methane and carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, adding to a warming climate. But a new study published online in the journal Nature Today indicates ancient lakes that formed after permafrost in the Arctic first melted roughly 10,000 years ago may, in fact, have a net climate cooling effect over long timescales. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the study also increases the total amount of carbon estimated in the frozen soils of the far north by more than 50%.
Katie Walter Anthony is an associate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She studies methane emissions from Arctic thermokarst lakes.
Until now, we have understood these thermokarst lakes, or lakes that form where permafrost thaws, to be a really important source of methane, a greenhouse gas that causes the climate to warm.
A few years ago, Anthony was in a boat on a river in Siberia when she noticed something in the sediments along the riverbank.
And we could see where ancient lakes had been eroded by the river, so we could see the lakes in cross-section. It looked like we were looking at a layered cake, but those layers were the layers of sediments in the lake. And we saw really thick beds of moss.
Sometime after the last glacial maximum, roughly 10,000 years ago, permafrost began to thaw. Depressions formed, filled with water, and eventually millions of small lakes started to dot the Arctic landscape. They were all emitting methane and carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases that warm the climate. Anthony says that process probably lasted for about 1,000 years.
But those water bodies sit around as lakes for several thousand years. And at some point, they burn up all of the permafrost carbon, and so their methane emissions decline. And they really, as they slow down in their methane emissions, they speed up in their ability to soak up carbon out of the atmosphere.
Over time, Anthony believes thick, carbon-rich beds of peat moss grew as microbial decomposition declined. She and her colleagues studied more than 50 ancient lakes in parts of Siberia and Alaska. In some places, she says they found beds of peat moss up to 4 meters or 12 feet thick.
We would walk up to these permafrost exposures and we could pull on those mosses, and it was like pulling long tendrils of spaghetti. They were poorly decomposed. And the reason is that when the mosses grow and then senesce in these lakes, they have anaerobic bottoms. There's no oxygen down there. And so the mosses don't decompose. And eventually, lakes drain. And when the lakes drain, the sediments really quickly refreeze. It's like flash freezing of those mosses.
Anthony believes lakes across the landscape have accumulated 1.6 times the amount of carbon they ever emitted before they refroze. She says that increases the total estimated amount of carbon scientists believe is currently stored in the circumpolar permafrost region by 50%. The results also show these ancient lakes actually have a net cooling effect on climate over thousands of years.
It's cooling the climate. It's soaking up more carbon than it's emitting. So it is offsetting human emissions. It's not a very large offset to human emissions. And I think the bigger concern is that all of this very large reservoir of lake moss peat, this lake carbon, is stored in permafrost since the lakes drain and their sediments refreeze when they drain.
Anthony doesn't believe this net cooling effect will offset current predictions for a warmer climate in the future.
So in the future, the projected warming of permafrost across the Arctic will thaw all of that carbon again and make it vulnerable to decomposition by microbes and return that carbon to the atmosphere as CO2 and methane.
The study is published in the most recent issue of Nature. Funding comes from the National Science Foundation, the Alfred Wegener Institute, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the U.S. Geological Survey. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Matthew Smith in Nome, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at craigtaylorequipment.com. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.